Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is committed to bringing you the stories and perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. From the peace activists demanding an end to war, to indigenous leaders fighting to stop fossil fuel extraction and save the planet. Our independent reporting is only possible because we're funded by you, not by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war or gun violence, not by the oil, gas, coal, or nuclear companies when we cover the climate crisis. We count on your generous support to keep Democracy Now! Going. Please make your donation of $5, $10, or more at democracynow.org. Every dollar counts. Thank you so much. We're counting on you. Stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
And so, to be clear, did you hear the White House counsel's office say that this plan to have alternate electors meet and cast votes for Donald Trump in states that he had lost was not legally sound?
Yes, sir.
At the fourth public hearing of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, state and local officials described threats and harassment they face from President Trump and his campaign to overturn the 2020 election. Among them, a black election worker and her mother in Georgia, whose lives were forever changed when Trump and Rudy Giuliani claimed the women helped rig the vote when Trump lost in their state.
There is nowhere I feel safe. Nowhere. Do you know how it feels to have the President of the United States to target you? The President of the United States is supposed to represent every American. Not to target one, but he targeted me.
We'll bring you their testimony, as well as other highlights from the hearing, including Republicans like Arizona House Speaker Rusty Bowers, who voted for Trump and said he would vote for him again, but said he and his family faced violent threats after Bowers refused Trump's request to overturn his election loss in his state.
Should name groups, but there was one gentleman that had the three bars on his chest. And he had a pistol and was threatening my neighbor, not with the pistol, but just vocally. When I saw the gun, I knew I had to get close.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Afghanistan, officials say at least 1,000 people have died, while some 1,500 have been injured after a powerful earthquake early Wednesday. The epicenter of the quake was about 30 miles from the city of Khalsa near the Pakistan border. Aftershocks were felt as far away as Kabul. Survivors described seeing numerous homes destroyed.
It was about midnight when the quake struck. It destroyed the houses of our neighbors. When we arrived, there were many dead and wounded. They sent us to the hospital. I also saw many dead bodies.
The earthquake comes at a time when Afghanistan is already facing one of the world's worst humanitarian and economic crises. A recent report by the Red Cross found 70% of Afghan households are unable to meet basic food needs, and an estimated 3 million Afghan children are at risk of malnutrition. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection has accused Donald Trump of playing a direct and personal role in pressuring state and local officials to help overturn Joe Biden's 2020 election victory. This is the committee chair, Benny Thompson.
What happened to Mike Pence wasn't an isolated part of Donald Trump's scheme to overturn the election. In fact, pressuring public servants into betraying their oaths was a fundamental part of the playbook.
Part of Trump's plan involves states sending fake slates of electors to be counted on January 6. The committee revealed Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson took part in the plot. On January 6, an aide to Johnson texted an aide to then-Vice President Mike Pence, saying Johnson wanted to hand Pence alternate slates of electors from Wisconsin and Michigan. Pence's aide responded by writing, quote, "Do not give that to him. We'll air highlights from Tuesday's hearing for the rest of the show after headlines." Ukrainian officials say Russian forces have captured several settlements near Lysychansk and Severodonetsk in eastern Ukraine as Russia moves closer to seizing all the Luhansk region. Meanwhile, at least 15 civilians have reportedly died in the Kharkiv region since Tuesday as Russia intensifies its shelling of the area. In other news on the war, U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland made an unannounced trip to Ukraine Tuesday. He announced the formation of a war crimes accountability team.
The United States is sending an unmistakable message. There is no place to hide. We and our partners will pursue every avenue available to make sure that those who are responsible for these atrocities are held accountable.
The wife of basketball superstar Brittany Griner says she has, quote, zero trust in the U.S. government. After it botched a plan to have the couple speak on Saturday for the first time since Brittany Griner was detained in Russia 4 months ago. Brittany Griner tried calling 11 times Saturday, but couldn't reach her wife on what was their fourth anniversary. The plan was for the call to go through the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. But no one was working on Saturday to connect the call. Brittany's wife, Sherelle Griner, told the Associated Press, quote, "I find it unacceptable, and I have zero trust in our government right now. If I can't trust you to catch a Saturday call outside business hours, how can I trust you to actually be negotiating on my wife's behalf to come home?" she said. The U.S. Senate has voted 64-34 to advance a new bipartisan gun safety bill based on an agreement reached by 10 Democrats and 10 Republicans. The bill includes enhanced background checks for gun buyers under the age of 21, and it closes a so-called boyfriend loophole. The Senate bill, however, does not include a number of gun control initiatives that were included in a recent bill approved by House Democrats, which aimed to ban the sale of large-capacity magazines and raise the minimum age to purchase an assault weapon from 18 to 21. An abject failure. That's how the head of the Texas State Police has described the response of local authorities to last month's mass shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, when an 18-year-old gunman shot dead 19 fourth graders and their two teachers. Colonel Steve McCraw, director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, made the comment Tuesday.
"There's compelling evidence that the law enforcement response to the attack at Robb Elementary was an abject failure and antithetical to everything we've learned over the last two decades since the Columbine massacre. 3 minutes after the subject entered the West Building, there was a sufficient number of armed officers wearing body armor to isolate, distract, and neutralize the subject. The only thing stopping a hallway of dedicated officers from entering room 111 and 112 was the on-scene commander, who decided to place the lives of officers before the lives of children."
Police had said they needed time to get a key to open the classroom's locked door. McGraw said the door was not locked and that no officer even checked to see if it was. McGraw also revealed one Uvalde police officer who was inside the school was detained while trying to save his wife, one of the two teachers shot dead. Ruben Ruiz was detained and had his gun taken away after he moved to approach the classroom where his wife was shot inside. She had phoned him. Primaries were held in Alabama, Virginia, Georgia, and Washington, D.C. on Tuesday. In Alabama, Kat Britt defeated Congressmember Mo Brooks in the Republican Senate primary to replace the retiring Senator Richard Shelby. Donald Trump had initially endorsed Brooks, who had helped organize the Stop the Steal rally, where Trump spoke just prior to the January 6 insurrection. But Trump later withdrew his endorsement and backed Britt after Brooks told a crowd to put the 2020 election behind them. In election news from Texas, a recount has confirmed Henry Cuellar, one of the most conservative Democrats in Congress, has defeated progressive challenger Jessica Cisneros in last month's House primary. Cuellar won by just under 300 votes. Cuellar is a corporate-backed, anti-choice, pro-gun Democrat who received backing from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and others in the Democratic establishment. In January, the FBI raided his home as part of a corruption investigation. Cuellar's campaign also got a major boost from APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. The group's super PAC spent over $1.8 million to get Cuellar reelected. The U.S. Supreme Court has issued a significant ruling on the separation of church and state. The court's six conservative justices ruled private religious schools in the state of Maine cannot be excluded from a program where the state pays tuition for some students attending private schools. Justice Sonia Sotomayor disagreed with the ruling, writing, quote, "Today the court leads us to a place where separation of church and state becomes a constitutional violation," she said. The Democratic Republic of Congo is preparing to soon hold 3 days of national mourning for slain independence leader Patrice Lumumba, who was assassinated in 1961. On Monday, Belgium, the former colonial power, handed over a tooth that a Belgian police officer said he took as a trophy after he helped cut up Lumumba's body, then dissolved it in acid. The tooth is believed to be the only remains left of Lumumba, who was killed a year after he became the first elected prime minister of the Congo in 1960. The CIA had ordered his assassination but could not complete the job. Instead, the United States and Belgium covertly funneled cash and aid to rival politicians who seized power and killed Lumumba. A coffin holding Lumumba's tooth is expected to fly from Brussels to Kinshasa today. Lumumba's son, Roland, spoke Tuesday.
In order for a soul to rest in peace, it needs to be buried, even if it's just part of the person's fingernail or hair, so that the mourning can be completed, and this can be done through this restitution.
In Ecuador, thousands of indigenous and social leaders took to the streets of the capital, Quito, and around the country for a ninth straight day on Tuesday, protesting right-wing President Guillermo Lasso's economic policies and rising fuel prices. Reuters reports police fired tear gas and so-called non-lethal projectiles at protesters. At least two people have died, nearly 100 injured, and dozens arrested. President Lasso has extended a state of emergency to at least six Ecuadorian provinces. Meanwhile, indigenous leaders said Tuesday they will not meet with government officials until security forces are withdrawn from certain areas of Quito. Lawmakers in El Salvador have voted to extend a state of emergency for another 30 days. The decree was first imposed in late March in response to rising homicides attributed to gangs. Since then, Salvadoran authorities have arrested more than 40,000 people. According to Amnesty International, at least 40 people have also died in state custody during that time. In Brazil, a third suspect in the murders of British journalist Dom Phillips and indigenous expert Bruno Araujo Pereira was arrested over the weekend. The suspect pointed police to the location of the speedboat in which Phillips and Pereira were traveling before they were murdered in early June. The bodies of the two were found buried last week near the banks of a river in the Javari Valley, a remote area of the Brazilian Amazon where they were shot dead. Meanwhile, Brazil's vice president said Phillips was, quote, collateral damage in an attack targeting Pereira. And a jury in California has found comedian Bill Cosby liable for sexually assaulting a woman at the Playboy Mansion in 1975 when she was just a teenager. The jury ordered Cosby to pay $500,000. The woman, Judy Hath, says the incident occurred when she was just 16 years old. She was represented by the attorney Gloria Allred.
Today, our client, Judy Hath, won real change because she fought Bill Cosby one step at a time for over 7.5 years. And she proved with the jury's verdict that Mr. Cosby did sexually assault her when she was a minor, and that he should be held and was held accountable for what he did to her.
Bill Cosby did not attend the civil trial and denied the charges. 11 months ago, he was released from prison in Pennsylvania after the state's high court threw out a sexual assault conviction in a different case. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection has accused Donald Trump of playing a direct and personal role in pressuring state and local officials to help overturn Joe Biden's 2020 election victory. This is the committee's chair, Benny Thompson.
What happened to Mike Pence wasn't an isolated part of Donald Trump's scheme to overturn the election. In fact, pressuring public servants into betraying their oaths was a fundamental part of the playbook.
The House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol held its fourth televised public hearing Tuesday with testimony from a series of Republican state officials who described the pressure they faced from then-President Donald Trump, Rudolph Giuliani, and their campaign to overturn the results of the 2020 election, as well as a black election worker in Georgia and her mother, whose lives were forever changed in December 2020, when Trump's top campaign lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, claimed the women had rigged the election vote when Trump lost Georgia. Many of the witnesses described severe harassment and threats of violence. Today, we bring you highlights of their testimony, beginning with Arizona House Speaker Rusty Bowers, a lifelong Republican who supported Arizona's voter suppression laws, voted for Trump, and even said he would vote for him again. Bowers testified about how he denied Trump's request to overturn his loss in Arizona by 10,457 votes by potentially removing Joe Biden's electors in the state. Bowers was questioned by January 6th committee member, Congressmember Adam Schiff, a Democrat of California.
After the election, you received a phone call from President Trump and Rudy Giuliani in which they discussed the result of the presidential election in Arizona. If you would, tell us about that call and whether the former president or Mr. Giuliani raised allegations of election fraud.
Thank you. My wife and I had returned from attending our church meetings. It was on a Sunday. And we were still in the driveway, and I had received a call from a colleague telling me that the White House was trying to get in touch with her and I, and that she said, please, if you get a call, let's try to take this together. Immediately, I saw that the White House on my Bluetooth was calling, and I took the call and was asked by the, I would presume, the operator at the White House if I would hold for the president, which I did, and Mr. Giuliani came on first, and niceties, then Mr. Trump, President Trump, then President Trump came on, and we initiated a conversation.
And during that conversation, you ask Mr. Giuliani for proof of these allegations of fraud that he was making?
On multiple occasions, yes.
And when you asked him for evidence of this fraud, what did he say?
He said that they did have proof, and I asked him, do you have names? For example, we have 200,000 illegal immigrants, some large number. 5,000 or 6,000 dead people, etc. And I said, do you have their names? Yes. Will you give them to me? Yes. The president interrupted and said, give the man what he needs, Rudy. He said, I will. And that happened on at least two occasions, that interchange in the conversation.
So Mr. Giuliani was claiming in the call that there were hundreds of thousands of undocumented people and thousands of dead people who had purportedly voted in the election?
Yes.
And you asked him for evidence of that?
I did.
And did you ever receive from him that evidence either during the call, after the call, or to this day?
Never.
What was the ask during this call? He was making these allegations of fraud, but he had something or a couple things that they wanted you to do. What were those?
The ones I remember were first that I would allow an official committee at the Capitol so that they could hear this evidence and that we could take action thereafter. And I refused. I said, Up to that time, the circus, I called it a circus, had been brewing with lots of demonstrations, both at the counting center, at the Capitol, and other places. And I didn't want to have that in the House. I did not feel that the evidence, granted in its absence, merited a hearing, and I didn't want to be used as a pawn if there was some other need that the committee hearing would fulfill. So that was the first ask, that we hold an official committee hearing.
And what was his second ask?
I said, to what end? To what end the hearing? He said, well, we have heard by an official high up in the Republican legislature that there is a legal theory or a legal ability in Arizona that you can remove the electors of President Biden and replace them. And we would like to have the legitimate opportunity through the committee to come to that end and remove that. And I said, that's something that's totally new to me. I've never heard of any such thing. And he pressed that point. And I said, look, you are asking me to do something that is counter to my oath when I swore to the Constitution to uphold it. And I also swore to the Constitution and the laws of the state of Arizona. And this is totally foreign as an idea or a theory to me. And I would never do anything of such magnitude without deep consultation with qualified attorneys. And I said, I've got some good attorneys and I'm going to give you their names. But you are asking me to do something against my oath, and I will not break my oath. And I think that was up to that point.
During the conversation, and you heard, I think, when we played a snippet of Mr. Giuliani calling other state legislators and saying that he was calling as essentially a fellow Republican, did he make a similar appeal to you or bring up the fact that you shared a similar party?
Whether it was in that call or in a later meeting, he did bring that up more than once.
And how would he bring that up?
He would say, aren't we all Republicans here? I would think we would get a better reception. I mean, I would think you would listen a little more open to my suggestions that we're all Republicans.
And this evidence that you asked him for that would justify this extraordinary step, I think you said they never produced. Why did you feel, either in the absence of that evidence or with it, what they were asking you to do would violate your oath to the Constitution?
First of all, when the people, and in Arizona, I believe it was some 40-plus years earlier, the legislature had established the manner of electing our officials, or the electors for the presidential race. Once it was given to the people, as in Bush v. Gore, illustrated by the Supreme Court, it becomes a fundamental right of the people. So as far as I was concerned, for someone to ask me in the, I would call it a paucity, there was no evidence being presented of any strength. Evidence can be hearsay evidence. It's still evidence, but it's still hearsay. But strong judicial quality evidence, anything that would say to me, you have a doubt, deny your oath. I will not do that. And on more than one occasion throughout all this, that has been brought up, and it is a tenet of my faith. That the Constitution is divinely inspired of my most basic foundational beliefs. And so for me to do that because somebody just asked me to is foreign to my very being. I will not do it.
Republican Arizona House Speaker Rusty Bowers, a longtime Trump supporter, testifying Tuesday to the House January 6th committee. He was questioned by Democratic Congress member Adam Schiff, who also asked Bowers about threats he and his family faced after he refused Trump's request to overturn the 2020 election.
Mr. Bowers, I understand that as you flew from Phoenix to Washington yesterday, you reflected upon some passages from a personal journal that you were keeping in December 2020 while all of this was taking place. With your permission, I'm wondering if you would be willing to share one passage in particular with us.
Thank you very much. It is painful to have friends who have been such a help to me turn on me with such rancor. I may, in the eyes of men, not hold correct opinions or act according to their vision or convictions, but I do not take this current situation in a light manner, a fearful manner, or a vengeful manner. I do not want to be a winner by cheating. I will not play with laws I swore allegiance to, with any contrived desire towards deflection of my deep foundational desire to follow God's will as I believe he led my conscience to embrace. How else will I ever approach him in the wilderness of life, knowing that I ask this guidance only to show myself a coward in defending the course he led me to take.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Those are powerful words. I understand that taking the courageous positions that you did following the 2020 election in defense of the rule of law and protecting the voters of Arizona resulted in you and your family being subjected to protests and terrible threats. Can you tell us how this impacted you and your family?
Well, as others in the videos have mentioned, we received, my secretaries would say, in excess of 20,000 emails and tens of thousands of voicemails and texts, which saturated our offices and we were unable to work, or at least communicate. But at home, up till even recently, it is the new pattern or a pattern in our lives to worry what will happen on Saturdays because we have various groups come by and they have had video panel trucks with videos of me proclaiming me to be a pedophile and a pervert and a corrupt and politician, and blaring loudspeakers in my neighborhood and leaving literature both on my property but arguing and threatening with neighbors and with myself. I don't know if I should name groups, but there was one gentleman that had the three bars on his chest and he had a pistol and was threatening my neighbor, not with the pistol, but just vocally. When I saw the gun, I knew I had to get close. And at the same time, on some of these, we had a daughter who was gravely ill, who was upset by what was happening outside. And my wife, that is a valiant person, very, very strong, quiet, very strong woman. So it was disturbing. It was disturbing.
Republican Arizona House Speaker Rusty Bowers, longtime Trump supporter, His daughter, Casey Bowers, died January 28, 2020, a few weeks after the January 6 insurrection. When we come back, we'll hear more testimony from the public hearing, including a black election worker and her mother in Georgia whose lives were forever changed when President Trump claimed the women helped to rig the vote when he lost Georgia. Stay with us.
Mr. Raffensperger.
I feel everything, I feel everybody. One man standing on two words, heal everybody. Transformation, then reciprocation. Karma must return, heal myself. Secrets that I hide, buried in these words. Death threats, ego must die. But I let it purge, pacify. Broken pieces of me, it was all a blur. Mother cried, put their hands on her. It was family ties, I heard it all. I should have grabbed a gun, but I was only five. I still feel it, weighing on my heart. My first tough decision. In the shadows, clinging to my soul as my only critic. Where's my faith? Told you I was Christian. But
Mother, I Sober by Kendrick Lamar. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. During Tuesday's hearing of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, members laid out the argument that then-President Trump and his campaign were directly involved in advancing and coordinating the plot to replace Biden electors with fake electors not chosen by the voters. This is a video presented as evidence that features Casey Lucier, an investigative counsel for the committee, describing the plan to organize fake electors for Trump in states where he had lost. It includes testimony of former Trump staffers who were involved in or aware of the plot, and lawyers and Republican officials who warned against it.
My name is Casey Lucier. I'm an investigative counsel for the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. On November 18th, a lawyer working with the Trump campaign named Kenneth Cheesebro wrote a memo arguing that the Trump campaign should organize its own electors in the swing states that President Trump had lost. The Select Committee received testimony that those close to President Trump began planning to organize fake electors for Trump in states that Biden won in the weeks after the election.
Who do you remember being involved in those early discussions around the Thanksgiving time regarding having alternate electors meet?
Mr. Giuliani, several of Mr. Giuliani's associates, Mr. Meadows, members of Congress, although it's difficult to distinguish if the members I'm thinking of were involved during Thanksgiving or if they were involved as we progress through December.
At the president's direct request, the RNC assisted the campaign in coordinating this effort.
What did the president say when he called you?
Essentially, he turned the call over to Mr. Eastman, who then proceeded to talk about the importance of the RNC helping the campaign gather these contingent electors in case any of the legal challenges that were ongoing changed the result of any of the states. I think more just helping them reach out and assemble them. But my understanding is the campaign did take the lead, and we just were helping them in that role.
As President Trump and his supporters continued to lose lawsuits, some campaign lawyers became convinced that convening electors in states that Trump lost was no longer appropriate.
I just remember I either replied or called somebody saying, unless we have litigation pending that's like in these states, like, I don't think this is appropriate, or, you know, this isn't the right thing to do. I don't remember how I phrased it, but and I got into a little bit of a back and forth, and I think it was with Ken Cheesebro, where I said, all right, you know, you just get after it. Like, I'm out.
At that point, I had Josh Finley email Mr. Cheesebro politely to say, this is your task. You are responsible for the Electoral College issues moving forward. And this was my way of taking that responsibility to zero.
The committee learned the White House counsel's office also felt the plan was potentially illegal.
And so to be clear, did you hear the White House counsel's office say that this plan to have alternate electors meet and cast votes for Donald Trump in states that he had lost was not legally sound?
Yes, sir.
And who was present for that meeting that you remember?
It was in our office. It was Mr. Meadows, Mr. Giuliani, and a few of Mr. Giuliani's associates.
The Select Committee interviewed several of the individual fake electors, as well as Trump campaign staff who helped organize the effort.
We were just, you know, kind of useful idiots or rubes at that point. You know, a strong part of me really feels that it's just kind of as the road continued and as that was failure, that got formulated as what do we have on the table? Let's just do it.
And now after what we've told you today about the Select Committee's investigation, about the conclusion of the professional lawyers on the campaign staff, Justin Clark, Matt Morgan, and Josh Finley, about their unwillingness to participate in the convening of these electors, how does that contribute to your understanding of these issues?
I'm angry because I think in a sense, you know, no one really cared if people were potentially putting themselves in jeopardy.
Would you have not wanted to participate in this any further as well?
I absolutely would not have. Had I known that the three main lawyers for the campaign that I'd spoken to in the past and were leading up were not on board.
I was told that these would only count if a court ruled in our favor. So that would have been using our electors. It would have been using our electors in ways that we weren't told about and we wouldn't have supported.
Documents obtained by the Select Committee indicate that instructions were given to the electors in several states that they needed to cast their ballots in complete secrecy. Because this scheme involved fake electors, those participating in certain states had no way to comply with state election laws, like where the electors were supposed to meet. One group of fake electors even considered hiding overnight to ensure that they could access the state capitol, as required in Michigan.
Did Mr. Norton say who he was working with at all on this effort to have electors meet?
He said he was working with the president's campaign. He told me that the Michigan Republican electors were planning to meet in the Capitol and hide overnight so that they could fulfill the role of casting their vote in per law in the Michigan chambers. And I told him in no uncertain terms that that was insane and inappropriate.
In one state, the fake electors even asked for a promise that the campaign would pay their legal fees if they got sued or charged with a crime. Ultimately, fake electors did meet on December 14, 2020, in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, New Mexico, Nevada, and Wisconsin. At the request of the Trump campaign, the electors from these battleground states signed documents falsely asserting that they were the, quote, duly elected electors from their state, and submitted them to the National Archives and to Vice President Pence in his capacity as President of the Senate. Here is what some of the fake elector certificates look like as compared to the real ones. But these ballots had no legal effect. In an email produced to the Select Committee, Dr. Eastman told a Trump campaign representative that it did not matter that the electors had not been approved by a state authority. Quote, the fact that we have multiple slates of electors demonstrates the uncertainty of either. That should be enough. He urged that Pence act boldly and be challenged. Documents produced to the Select Committee show that the Trump campaign took steps to ensure that the physical copies of the fake electors' electoral votes from two states were delivered to Washington for January 6th. Text messages exchanged between Republican Party officials in Wisconsin show that on January 4th, the Trump campaign asked for someone to fly their fake electors' documents to Washington. A staffer for Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson texted a staffer for Vice President Pence just minutes before the beginning of the joint session. This staffer stated that Senator Johnson wished to hand deliver to the Vice President the fake electors' votes from Michigan and Wisconsin. The Vice President's aide unambiguously instructed them not to deliver the fake votes to the Vice President. Even though the fake elector slates were transmitted to Congress and the executive branch, the vice president held firm in his position that his role was to count lawfully submitted electoral votes.
Joseph R. Biden Jr. of the state of Delaware has received 306 votes. Donald J. Trump of the state of Florida has received 232 votes.
Which is what he did when the joint session resumed on January 6th after the attack on the Capitol.
That's a video narrated by Casey Lucier, an investigative counsel for the January 6th committee, presented as evidence during Tuesday's hearing. One of the witnesses who testified live was the Republican Georgia Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger. The January 6th committee member, Congressman Adam Schiff, refers to a call between Trump and Georgia investigator Francis Watson in his questioning of Raffensperger.
Mr. Raffensperger, I know you weren't on this call, but that you have listened to it. President Trump didn't win by hundreds of thousands of votes in Georgia, did he?
No, he did not. I've been traveling through the state of Georgia for a year now, and simply put, in a nutshell, what happened in fall of 2020 is that 28,000 Georgians skipped the presidential race, and yet they voted down ballot in other races. And the Republican congressman ended up getting 33,000 more votes than President Trump. And that's why President Trump came up short.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. The president on this call doesn't stop here. Let's listen to another part of the conversation between President Trump and Ms. Watson. Whatever you can do, Francis. This is the President of the United States calling an investigator looking into the election in which he is a candidate and asking her to do whatever you can do. Mr. Secretary, he placed this call to your chief investigator on September 23rd, 2020. The Select Committee has received text messages indicating that Mark Meadows wanted to send some of the investigators in her office, in the words of one White House aide, load of POTUS stuff, including coins, actual autographed MAGA hats, etc. White House staff intervened to make sure that didn't happen. It was clear at the time of this call that the former president had his sights set on January 6th. Listen to this portion when he told Francis Watson about a very important date. That important date, of course, was the joint session of Congress, where Georgia's electoral votes would be counted for Joe Biden. A little over a week after this call to Francis Watson, the president was finally able to speak with you, Secretary Raffensperger. Bear in mind, as we discuss this call today, that by this point in time, early January, the election in Georgia had already been certified. But perhaps more important, the president of the United States had already been told repeatedly by his own top Justice Department officials that the claims he was about to make to you about massive fraud in Georgia were completely false.
That's committee Congress member Adam Schiff questioning Republican Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. When we come back, we'll hear testimony to the January 6th committee from a black election worker and her mother in Georgia, whose lives were forever changed when Trump claimed the women helped to rig the vote when he lost Georgia. Stay with us. Running Up That Hill by Kate Bush. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Some of the most dramatic testimony of Tuesday's hearing of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol came from Shay Moss, a former Georgia state election worker who describes threats against her mother and grandmother during questioning by California Congressmember Adam Schiff. She was joined by her mother, Ruby Freeman, who testified earlier to the committee. Her comments featured during the questioning. This is Schiff and Shay Moss.
How did you first become aware that Rudy Giuliani, the president's lawyer, was accusing you and your mother of a crime?
I was at work, like always, and A former chief, Mr. Jones, asked me to come to his office. And when I went to his office, the former director, Mr. Barron, was in there. And they showed me a video on their computer. It was just like a very short clip of us working at State Farm. And it had someone on the video, like, talking over the video, just saying that we were doing things that we weren't supposed to do, just lying throughout the video. And that's when I first found out about it.
And were there social media posts that they showed you responding to those false claims?
Well, when I saw the video, of course, the first thing that I said was like, why are they doing this? What's going on? And they, you know, just told me that Trump and his allies were not satisfied with the outcome of the election, and they were getting a lot of threats and being harassed online, and asked me, you know, have I been receiving anything, and I need to check on my mom. And I told them, I was like, where have they, you know, where have you been getting these threats? I don't believe I have any. And Mr. Jones told me, like, they're attacking his Facebook, and I don't really use Facebook. I have one. So I went to the Facebook app, and I'm just kind of panicky at this point because this has never happened to me, and my mom is involved, and I'm like her only child. So I'm just asking him, like, well, where are the messages? All I see is the feeds. Like, how do you get to the messages? And he said, it's another icon on your phone that says Messenger. And I went to that icon, and it was just a lot of horrible things there.
And those horrible things, did they include threats?
Yes, a lot of threats, wishing death upon me, telling me that, you know, I'll be in jail with my mother, and saying things like, be glad it's 2020 and not 1920. That's, yeah.
Were a lot of these threats and vile comments racist in nature?
A lot of them were racist. A lot of them were just hateful. Yes, sir.
In one of the videos we just watched, Mr. Giuliani accused you and your mother of passing some sort of USB drive to each other. What was your mom actually handing you on that video?
A ginger mint.
It wasn't just Rudy Giuliani. We heard President Trump make these false allegations repeatedly during his call with Secretary Raffensperger. Let's listen to a portion of what he had to say about you and your mother.
We had at least 18,000, that's on tape, we had them counted very painstakingly, 18,000 voters having to do with Ruby Freeman. She's a vote scammer, a professional vote scammer and hustler.
Donald Trump attacked you and your mother using her name 18 times on that call. 18 times. Ms. Moss, can you describe what you experienced listening to former President Trump attack you and your mother in a call with the Georgia Secretary of State?
I felt horrible. I felt like it was all my fault. Like, if I would have never decided to be an elections worker, like, I could have done anything else, but that's what I decided to do. And now people are lying and spreading rumors and lies and attacking my mom, my only child, going to my grandmother's house, her only grandchild, and my kid. It's just, I felt so bad. I just felt bad for my mom, and I felt horrible for picking this job and being the one that always wants to help and always there. never missing not one election. I just felt like it was my fault for putting my family in this situation.
Well, it wasn't your fault. Your mother was kind enough to come speak with us earlier. Let's listen to her story and her words.
My name is Ruby Freeman. I've always believed that when God says that he'll make your name great, but this is not the way it was supposed to be. I could have never imagined the events that followed the presidential election 2020. For my entire professional life, I was Lady Ruby. My community in Georgia, where I was born and lived my whole life, knew me as Lady Ruby. I built my own business around that name, La Ruby's Unique Treasures, a pop-up shop catering to ladies with unique fashions. I wore a shirt that proudly proclaimed that I was, and I am, Lady Ruby. Actually, I had that shirt in every color. I wore that shirt on Election Day 2020. I haven't worn it since, and I'll never wear it again. Now I won't even introduce myself by my name anymore. I get nervous when I bump into someone I know in the grocery store who says my name. I'm worried about who's listening. I get nervous when I have to give my name for food orders. I'm always concerned of who's around me. I've lost my name, and I've lost my reputation. I've lost my sense of security. All because a group of people, starting with number 45 and his ally, Rudy Giuliani, decided to scapegoat me and my daughter, Shay, to push their own lies about how the presidential election was stolen.
Ms. Moss, how has this experience of being targeted by the former president and his allies affected your life?
It's turned my life upside down. I no longer give out my business card. I don't transfer calls. I don't want anyone knowing my name. I don't want to go anywhere with my mom because she might yell my name out over the grocery aisle or something. I don't go to the grocery store at all. I haven't been anywhere at all. I've gained about 60 pounds. I just don't do nothing anymore. I don't want to go anywhere. I second guess everything that I do. It's affecting my life in a major way. In every way. All because of lies. For me doing my job, same thing I've been doing forever.
Your mother also told this committee about how she had to leave her own home for her safety and go into hiding after the FBI told her that it would not be safe for her there before January 6th and until the inauguration. Let's listen to a clip of her story in her own words.
Around the week of January 6th, the FBI informed me that I needed to leave my home for safety. And I left my home for safety around that time.
Understood. How long did you stay out? Did you, remain outside of your home for your own safety?
I stayed away from my home for approximately 2 months. It was horrible. I felt homeless. I felt, I can't believe this person has caused this much damage to me and my family. To have to leave my home that I've lived there for 21 years. And, I'm having to have my neighbors watch out for me, and I have to go and stay with somebody. It was hard. It was horrible.
And that your conversation with the FBI about needing to leave your home for your own safety or perhaps recommending it. Do you remember, was there a specific threat that prompted that, or was it the accumulation of threats that you had received?
What prompted it was getting ready to January 6th was about to come. And they did not want me to be at home because of all the threats and everything that I had gotten. They didn't want me to be there in fear of, you know, the people would come into my home. And I had a lot of that. So they didn't want me to be there just in case something happened. I asked, how long am I going to have to be at home? They said, at least until the inauguration.
Ms. Moss, I understand that people once showed up at your grandmother's house. Tell us about that experience.
I received a call from my grandmother. This woman is my everything. I've never even heard her or seen her cry ever in my life. And she called me, screaming at the top of her lungs, like, Shay, oh my God, Shay, just freaking me out, saying that there were people at her home, and they, you know, they knocked on the door, and of course she opened it, and seeing who was there, who it was, and they just started pushing their way through, claiming that they were coming in to make a citizen's arrest. They needed to find me and my mom. They knew we were there. And she was just screaming and didn't know what to do. And I wasn't there, so, you know, I just felt so helpless and so horrible for her. And she was just screaming. I told her to close the door. Don't open the door for anyone. And no, she's a 70-something, I won't say, year old woman, and she doesn't like having restrictions. She wants to answer the door. She likes to get her steps in, walking around the neighborhood, and I had to tell her, like, you can't do that. You have to be safe. You know, she would tell me that at night, people would just continuously send pizzas over and over to her home, you know, and they were expecting her to pay for these large amounts of pizzas, and she went through a lot that she didn't have to. And once again, it made me just feel so horrible.
In addition to the personal impact this experience has had on you and your family, one of the things that I find most disturbing is how these lies discourage longtime election workers from continuing to do this important work. Tell us, if you would, of the other election workers shown in that State Farm Arena video and their supervisors. How many are still election workers in Fulton County?
There is no permanent election worker or supervisor in that video that's still there.
And did you end up leaving your position as well?
Yes, I left.
Ms. Moss, I want to thank you for coming to speak with us and to thank you for your service to our democracy. What we have just played is a truly horrible and appalling sample, but just a sample of the things that were said about you and your mother following the election. I want to say how very sorry I think we all are for what you've gone through, and tragically, you're not alone. Other election workers around the country have also been the subject of lies and threats. No election worker should be subject to such heinous treatment just for doing their job. With your permission, I would like to give your mother the last word.
Yes.
We're just going to play the tape.
There is nowhere I feel safe. Nowhere. Do you know how it feels to have the President of the United States to target you? The President of the United States is supposed to represent every American, not to target one. But he targeted me, Lady Ruby, a small business owner, a mother, a proud American citizen who stand up to help Fulton County run an election in the middle of the pandemic.
Deposition video of Ruby Freeman, mother of Shay Moss, both former Georgia state election workers, whose testimony was heard Tuesday by the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. Ruby was sitting behind her daughter during Shay's testimony. To see all four public hearings in full, you can go to democracynow.org. We're also live streaming the fifth hearing on Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dean Augusta, Messiah Rhodes, Noreen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Cam Baker. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.